Hi, my name is Dev, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers in any case. We hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Harry will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Harry. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Sheila will read the steps.
Hi, my name's Sheila. I'm an alcoholic. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Tom will read the traditions.
My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. Our AA experience has taught us that, 1, each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great... The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants that do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse finance or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Ivan.
My name is Ivan. I am an alcoholic. And without a doubt, my home with the Atlantic Group. The reason why I say that, because of Ben Lederer. Ben Lederer, one of the founding fathers, as well as Peggy Burns, one of the founding mothers of this group, fabulous group. I was working in the hospital when he passed away, Ben Lederer. And I'm one of the guys, unfortunately, I took him to the funeral. And I have the spiritual connection with Ben Lederer. Ben, rest in peace. You know, my story, I'm grateful to be here. It's been a dream to, my role, I always sit in row 16. Come in, I just sit in row 16 with my family sponsor that I love to death. And I will go any stream with him, Dr. Philip T. My grand sponsor is continue showing me how hard it could be if I go out. Ron Black, Hale Black, excuse me. And but I have a great supporting group that really love me more than I love myself. You know, this is my second time in recovery. I had 9 years. Now I got August 25th, 2006. I have right now 2 years and 3 months. I never forget where a gentleman in my old home group, a faculty. He spoke and said, if you don't change, guess what? Your sobriety today will change. And you know what? I wasn't willing to change. And you know what? I went back, I went out. And came back. And it was no shame coming back. Because everybody opened their arms and supported me and told me what's right and wrong and how to stay sober at their time. I'm a bit nervous. My experience, strength, and hope. You know, it didn't matter that dysfunctional family, parents. Did not matter if I had abusive parents. Did not matter that my parents was an alcoholic and my mother was insane in psychiatry. Did not matter. What mattered was my symptom, as it says in the big book, body was only a symptom. And that was my story. I drank from the age of 8 years old to the age of 37 when I first came in. I know I look great, but I'm 50 years old, and that's what happened in recovery. And I don't know, that's why God bless me more than I bless myself, I don't know. But at 8 years old, I felt left out. And I'm not talking about left out in a group, I'm not talking about not fitting in. I'm talking about literally being left out. I mean, people always ask me, where are you from? And very simply, I'm Puerto Rican and Italian, depending on how I wake up in the morning from my bed. You know, at 8 years old, I got left back twice. I was born in Puerto Rico in first grade, not second grade, not fifth grade, not high school, first grade. Off the bat, I got left back, first grade. And being left back, I ended up to be the oldest kid in class. And being the oldest kid in class, I felt very alone. I felt very long at home. I got my brothers in recovery in California, Santa Monica, from Pacific Group. Anybody from Pacific Group? My brother practiced in Pacific Group, over 18 years in Pacific Group. My sister's in recovery. But I was always the oldest one in the family, and felt was left out. Left out at home, left out in school, left out with my friends, never got into sports. I was overwhelmed, totally overwhelmed. Is anybody timing? I don't see anybody timing me. Okay, thank you. Okay, because I'm out. Okay. I was totally overwhelmed by the fear of self-hate I had for myself and hopelessness. So at 8 years old, I picked up a drink. I think some of you might know of them, old-timers in this room, when you're having more than one as an alcoholic, Budweiser's. So I was started drinking my Bud Weiser, my first drink. And it felt good going down my throat. It fulfilled my craving. Emotionally, spiritually, I felt numb that I could deal with going to school, being the oldest kid, being a family. I thought that drinking for me, when I drank, was medicating all the feeling. It didn't medicate the feeling. It was great. I mean, I drank Budweiser's, I drank Heineken's, Old English, Coke 45. And then I graduated when I was in high school. Then I started drinking rum and Coke. And then when I had my 9 years of recovery, I decided I'm going to Las Vegas. So now I'm ordering some fancy drinks, cream drinks I never heard of before, like Dirty Godmother. Thank you. Dirty Godmother. I mean, real fancy drinks. And, you know, but unfortunately, from the age of 8 years, of 8 years old to the age of 37, when I came into the room, it medicated so much that my life played a very important role, denial and consequences. My denial told me, go ahead, have another drink. Go ahead. You can have another drink. Nothing's going to happen to you. My denial, my consequences told me, don't you dare have another drink. Because for me, I didn't end up in jail. I didn't end up in a mental institution. Always been my consequences. Up to this day, always been my health. I know I look great. I look fabulous, but I'm also I'm a chronic diabetic on a pump, and I must say that very sincerely, because that's where it led me to. I mean, by the time I was 12, I started losing my hair. I got alopecia. Oh, I got alopecia, I got ulcers, I got diabetes, I got asthma, and for some reason, God still kept me in the room. God loved me more than I love myself. You know, the only difference between now, with my feelings I feel, and when I felt when I was drinking, they have the tools. That AA taught me the tools. I have a high power in my understanding. I got to 12 steps. I have a great sponsor. I got a sponsor, a great home group right here. You guys are great, each one of you that I met. And having the tools was make me look at things a little bit different. You know, I will stay sober. If I could help one person today in the room, because I'm not here for myself. I mean, I know I'm sober. I'm not here for myself. I'm here for the first person. I'm here for the person who comes in for the first time in this room tonight and don't know how to stay away from the drink, or someone who just relapsed and don't know what direction to take. You know, I could show you that if you surrender, I call it the five feds of the room, five feds of Alcoholic Anonymous. Surrender, spirituality, sponsor, steps, and service. The five presidents in the room. When I came back, after 9 years, I had a fabulous time in Las Vegas, I must say. But for me, my bottom was, I had two bottoms. I call it two different bottoms. I had diabetic shock, which led me into intensive care unit. Again, my consequence has always been my health. That's why I don't drink today. I could say that each day I wake up, my life is beyond my wildest dream. And my wildest dream is not having a $100,000 job. It's not having a beautiful wife. It's not having a house in the suburb. My wildest dream is that I'm waking up each day. I'm no longer a prisoner to alcohol. I'm free. I'm free from alcohol. I'm obsessed about picking up the drink. God took the obsession away from my life, from picking up the drink. And I don't longer have the landlord knocking on my door. It's time for rent. I don't have that no more. My rent is always on time. I live a very happy, joyous, and free because of the grace of God, my sponsor, my home group, the Atlanta group, my strobe says that practice to my best of my ability. I listen to best of my ability. This is not a perfect program for me. I'm a stubborn alcoholic. But I do listen. I do ask for help. And I do follow suggestion. To my best of my ability. I mean, I could tell you that some suggestion I haven't followed and some suggestion I'm still struggling with it, but I'm sober today. Thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Rachel.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to start with the basics. I have a sponsor. Her name is Tika. My sobriety date is February 3rd of this year, so I just celebrated 9 months yesterday. Thank you. My home group is the Atlantic Group, and I'm on step 11, working 9, practicing 10 and 11. So I'm just going to start with how it was from the beginning. I grew up in a nice family, hardly any drinking. I've never seen my father take a drink because he doesn't like the taste, which I kind of thought he was lying for a long time about that because it made no sense to me. And my mom used to have, like, one Mike's Hard Lemonade with dinner, and that was it. There was no abuse, verbal or otherwise. Nothing was wrong. I went to good schools. I got good grades. I had nice friends. The only thing that I can blame for making me an alcoholic is the way that I feel when I drink and the way that I felt when I didn't drink. Let's see. I went to an all-girls school in the city, and I was a big dork in middle school. I was really good at math and science, and I liked computers. And then I switched schools for high school. I went to a co-ed school, and at the same time, I started drinking. So most of the socializing that I learned how to do was with drinking. And it seemed to work for me. I got a lot of compliments on myself when I was drinking. I was apparently really funny and way more outgoing than I would have been otherwise. So I figured I would just do it all the time. And then it stopped being funny. The thing that I remember most is I became a burden on the people that I was with. They had to take care of me. I wasn't someone whose company they enjoyed. I was someone who had to be dealt with and picked up and taken home and covered for the next morning so that my parents didn't know what had happened and cleaned up after. So the reasons that I had started using alcohol for kind of went away, but I didn't stop doing it. I think part of what kept me sort of sane throughout high school was living with my parents. I had a curfew, I had rules, I had to follow them, and I went away to college in September 2006 and came home for winter break and was in rehab by Christmas Eve. So I had a pretty quick downhill turn when I went to college. I had no concept of limiting myself. Any time that I'd stopped drinking, it was for other people. Like, I need to stop because I need to go home. And there was no needing to go home anymore. So I did whatever I wanted, and whatever I wanted was getting drunk. Now, the thing is, I always needed to, like, keep up appearances, so I couldn't be drunk all day. So I had to, like, come up with really good excuses to drink, like traveling. If I was going to be getting on a train and going somewhere that day, that was an excuse. If it was sunny out or I didn't have class, that was an excuse. I remember actually the last election day of 2004, my friend wanted to go watch the elections together. And I was like, oh no, it doesn't sound like he wants to drink while we do this. And election day sounds like a perfectly valid excuse to drink. So I was in rehab by December of my first year of college. I didn't want to be there. I had no idea what I was doing there. I thought a terrible mistake had been made, and I didn't know how to get out of it. And that's pretty much how I felt for the next year and a half. Yeah, I felt like every day I woke up and I thought something had gone terribly, terribly wrong. I felt like I had made like one little mistake. Like if I hadn't come home that night and attacked my dad to get out of the house, this never would have happened. Or if I didn't want to go out that night and drink, if I had just stayed in that night, this never would have happened. And that was all I could think about for a year and a half. I was in and out of many, many treatment centers in that time. Thank you. And I just wouldn't let them do anything. I'm sure they were great places, but I wasn't having any of it. So what happened and what it's like now. In February of this year, February 2nd, I went up to visit my best friend at college for her birthday, and she said it was okay if I drank, and I acted terribly, so terribly that she wouldn't speak to me the next morning. She was disgusted, and she told me that if I didn't stop drinking, she wouldn't be able to speak to me anymore. And that wasn't the problem. The problem was that I considered it. I was ready to give up my best friend to drink. And that's when I realized that this is really a big problem. So I went to another treatment center. It's a big part of my story. Not everyone's, but it is mine. I got out in May, and I came to Atlanta Group one night, and they had said that the meeting books were free for newcomers. And I was like, well, I have more than 90 days, but I guess I'm a newcomer. So I went to, and I just like picked one up. And Jeff, thank you very much, asked me if I had 90 days and then informed me that I had to pay for it. So I felt terribly awkward and gave him the $1.50. And then I guess he could see that I felt terribly awkward and asked me if I had a sponsor. And I didn't. So he introduced me to my sponsor, and I got very lucky. I have a sponsor who is the best example that I could have to follow, and I want to grow up and be just like her. And and that really helps when she's giving me direction that I don't necessarily want to do, or yeah, it happens. And I realize that if I do it, I might have a chance of having some of the serenity and peace and joy that she has in her life. So there's some stuff that I do on a daily basis. I wake up every morning. I get on my knees and pray, which is so weird. I never would have thought that I could have done that. I still feel a little weird sometimes, but honestly, I'm really used to it now. And I just kind of think of my God as like a buddy that I can talk to. So that really works for me. I get on my knees, I pray, make my bed, go through my day, write my 10-step most nights. I try. Meditate when I get a chance. Meditated in the cab on the way over here. And that's my favorite part of this program, I think, is that I've found ways to really, like, use it all the time. Just doing random things, like walking through the park, I'll stop and meditate. Or talking to a friend, I'll realize that I've said something wrong and apologize. I accidentally hit someone here with a cigarette a few weeks ago. And I made like a really quick apology, and I was like, no, you really need to apologize for that. And I asked a friend, and she was like, yeah, you do. That's another thing that I've done, is I've surrounded myself with people who I think have what I want. I hang out with a lot of sober people who have more time than me, my age, older, all sorts of people. And just being around people who are doing what you want to be doing is really, really important for me, because if I'm around people who are doing what I don't want to be doing, I tend to follow them. I have a higher power that's really important to me. This is the only place where I feel really comfortable saying that, because I know you all understand. It's my one constant in my life, no matter what's going on. And I've come to depend on it, and that's an utter miracle. I never would have been comfortable with that before. If there are any newcomers here, I'm sure there are. There always are. if I can promise you one thing, it's that it's going to get a lot better no matter what you've done in the past. No matter what you will do in the future, you can always make it better. And that's what this program is about. It's not about not drinking, which is all that I thought it was about. And I think that's pretty normal to come in thinking it's just about not drinking. It's about getting your life back and living it in a way that is esteemable. We all have good lives. That's what I love about this place, is everybody is really leading a life that they want to, and it's amazing. I love this home group. There's no place like it. There's no place so where everyone's smiling all the time. That's the best part, is everyone's happy to be here and to see each other. And you can tell that it's real. It's not forced. It's not fake. I don't know. I thought I was going to be more nervous. So I'm pretty happy. So for the newcomer, listen to the suggestions people give you. Find a home group that you like. Find people that you respect, that you want to be like. Stick with them. Listen to them. Not just your sponsor. Get a sponsor, though. They're really important, and they're just great to have. I feel so lucky. I'm so lucky. I have like this person that I can call when I have a problem, who gives me good advice, not that my parents aren't great and I call them all the time too, but she's working the same program as me. She just wants me to do well. And that's what a sponsor is. They just want to help you. And get a sponsor, and it's all uphill from here. That's it.
And tonight, our main speaker is Jim H.
Good. Hi, my name is Jim Herr, and I'm an alcoholic. I was a little nervous before I began. It was absolutely thrilling to turn around and see all the people who were counting days. I remember, you know, I have 17 years sober, and I never could have believed that this would happen to me, you know, and that that I would stay sober. Thank you. So I'd like to begin by thanking Peggy, thanking Joel, thanking Bob for asking me to speak, thanking, as I look out, you know, so many people have helped me with their experience, strength, and hope, and also thanking the people who do service at this meeting, who carry such a strong message that I need, and for the newcomer. And, you know, hearing the people counting days, I will start by saying that I absolutely believe that I have no knack for sobriety. I have no insight into sobriety. I had no special susceptibilities to sobriety. You know, it didn't, you know, there was nothing in me that made it available to me that I think it's not available to you. You know, I wholeheartedly believe that. I pretty much didn't believe it would work and did what I was told, and it worked. You know, that's pretty much what happened. I love drinking, you know, and I drank a lot, and I love the effect, and I drank for the effect, and I also love the process. I love drinking in bars. I also love drinking at home. I love the bar life. I loved, you know, I loved bartenders. I loved spending time in bars. I thought a significant part of my life was going to be in bars. And I thought, like, that was the urbane life. That was where the real life was going to occur. There was going to be work. There was going to be, you know, divorce. But there wasn't going to be... But a significant part of my life was going to, you know, the meaningful part of my life was going to be in a bar. And I honestly believe that. I was okay with that. You know, and I got that. I didn't get the divorce, and I didn't get a marriage, but I got the bar life. I got the bar life, and I loved it. I drank in bars a lot, and I drank. You know, I think there's almost, you know, this, what I've heard so much is true for me, and I've noticed it with so many other people that I've heard qualify, is, you know, my drinking was unhealthy and unmanageable and dangerous to people around me, and then it got bad, you know? And then it got bad, and then it got dark, you know? That's what happened for me. You know, I stopped drinking when I was 31. After several treatment centers and hospitalizations. I totaled all the cars when I was in my early 20s. You know, and it's easy, if I want to do a very short qualification of what it was like, I can always go to the cars. I totaled 4 cars, I pulled several windshields out of my forehead. And that's not why I stopped drinking, I'm okay with that. You know, I didn't have a problem with that. It seemed like terrifically unfortunate and not more than that. A couple of years ago, I did realize that I crashed a boat. a cabin cruiser, literally, and I felt like these guys are going to be so thrilled. They're not going to have to hear about these cars. I was drunk, you know, and there was no way. I crashed into rocks and pushed it into a channel. I could have imagined that I was an alcoholic when I was in my early 20s. Certainly in bars, people I drank with in bars commented on my drinking and told me to pull back. 21, you know. I thought several things. I thought that something would happen would make this behavior unnecessary. I was drinking out of pain, or I was drinking out of, you know, I just needed this, you know. I drank every night. I thought that something outside myself, you know, a career, a girl, something, you would come into my life and make this unnecessary. It would just, like, vanish. I would have something else. I would have, you know, life, you know. And what I had was, you know, pain and anxiety and anger. Alternately, I thought that, you know, okay, I had crashed a bunch of cars, but if it got bad, it wasn't really going to get bad for a long time, and I was going to have time to pull it back. Which turned out not to be true. I just thought I'd be able to manage it. I thought, you know, I thought it was really true and possible. And, you know, my drinking was crazy. But, and people told me that. But I was going to get away with it, you know. Or it would change. As time went on, my drinking got, you know, I had all the crazy times, I had the wild times, I had the crash cars, I had, you know, I used alcohol for license to misbehave and, you know, all that. And then as time went on, it got to be more of a, you know, more lonely, more urgent, more isolated. I had to lie about it more. I had less glamorous repercussions, you know. Assuming that crashing, totaling four cars is glamorous, less glamorous. I could not get to work in any kind of reliable way. I could not tell the truth in any kind of reliable way. I wholeheartedly believe that I was not the kind of person to do things I did, and I did them, you know. I was not the kind of person to steal from, you know. I was not the kind of person to sneak into my girlfriend's apartment to steal my birthday present, to sell it. You know, I was not the kind of person to sell my clothes. I was not the kind of person. By the way, I'm a drinker. You know, I had some drugs, but, like, I love drinking. That was my thing. I was not the kind of person to lie like I did. Nevertheless, I lied. I stole money from work over and over again, and I insisted that I wasn't going to do it again. And I was shocked at my behavior and disappointed in myself. And I, for a long time, it worked that I could say, you know, I'm not really this kind of guy. So, you know, that was like a free pass because, you know, yes, I'm doing it, but that's not the kind of person I am. And then, you know, the heartbreaking feeling of realizing that that is the kind of person you are, you know, that you will do that over and over and over again, you know, and then disappointment, self-hatred, and on and on with that. You know, and I spent a lot of time in bars. You know, my drinking was not social. You know, the best. I mean, occasionally, if I walk, you know, you look at a liquor ad or something. I honestly don't want to drink. But if I'm on a sunny, brilliant sunny day, you know, a gorgeous day, if I walk by a bar at, you know, 11:30 in the morning and smell the disgusting biological smell wafting out, I feel like, yeah, you know, that sounds great. You know. That has some appeal. I drank, you know, in the middle of the day in old man bars and tried to figure out what was wrong with my life, you know. And I came up with some answers, you know. And I came up with insane answers, you know. I came up with answers alone, and I didn't tell anyone, and I tried to put them into effect, you know. I came up with silly, silly answers. I ended up in a banquet after the meeting a few month ago or so, and I had a math thing, you know, that was like to try to correct my drinking. I decided on a train. I remember where I was standing on the train, you know, that I had a math phobia. And if I dealt with that math phobia, my life would be different. So I took all the math for an engineering degree, and I realized it wasn't the math, you know. And it took me a while, you know, and I was like, had this urgent thing. This is in my early 20s. I had this urgent thing where I would, like, you know, just crazy, you know, in the library till, you know, which libraries, reading other books, gotten a tutor from Berkeley, you know, that kind of thing. And I was in danger of actually, like, you know, I don't know, becoming an engineer or something, which I'd never wanted to be, you know. And I realized it wasn't like I could do it. You know, I passed the courses and I, you know, had that. I don't mean to say that I stopped drinking. I drank and I got drunk and I, you know, I blacked out. I was a blackout drinker. But I also had this, like, urgent phobia that I needed to correct, you know, that I had an answer. You know, my suggestion is, if you come up with an answer like that, don't tell anyone, because they'll try to talk you out of it, you know. And I had, you know, I'd sit in bars and try to figure out what was wrong with my life, you know. What was wrong with my life, you know? Why didn't it work for me? I remember, like, being in Midtown and thinking, you know, looking at the lights and thinking, like, every one of those lights represents a manageable life. And, like, I can't do it. I can't. I never maintained an apartment. I lost every apartment I ever had. I still have never moved out of an apartment. Every apartment I ever had, I stopped going back. I just stopped. I've been in my apartment for almost as long as I've been sober. I moved from a halfway house into my apartment, and I stayed. I've never moved furniture or clothing out of an apartment. I left everything that I ever had at those apartments. I might still be living there, you know. Here's what happened. It got bad, and I wanted to kill myself every single day. You know, every single day, every single night, I wanted to die. You know, I wanted to kill myself, you know. And I had suicide in my family, my brother, and it was, you know, awful. And you know, it was a fixation not to make the same errors, you know. So that was like a satisfying fantasy for a couple of years. But the air keeps leaking out of the balloon, and life keeps getting worse and more unmanageable and more painful. I'm just beyond it. So I did, I had like periods of therapy where I tried to tell people about my drinking, and I lied after, you know. And I did an outpatient clinic at Gracie Square Hospital. First place I saw the steps, and I immediately thought, there is no way on earth that I'm doing that. That's not for me. Except for step 9, which seemed to me like a reset button, you know, that you could, like, apologize with feeling and maybe get more money. Honest to God, I felt like if I could do that, because I did feel genuinely guilty, you know. So I started going to AA meetings, and I, you know, it didn't work. I couldn't stay sober. I did an outpatient clinic for 30 days. I was sure I'd never drink again. I put on 20 pounds in 2 weeks, you know, these 20 pounds, you know. In the last couple of years, I was, you know, black eyes, split lips, God knows where they came from, you know, broken noses. Wake up, maybe I remembered, maybe I didn't, you know. I'd attract drug dealers on the street. I'd get out of my car to fist fight with strangers. Okay, so I'm gonna make it a little quicker now. I couldn't get sober. I couldn't stop drinking, you know. And it felt to me as if I were trying to be trained to control the rain. You know, I just couldn't do it. Sometimes it rained, you know. Sometimes I just ended up drunk. It seemed to have nothing to do with what I did whatsoever, you know. I did three treatment centers, and then I did a halfway house, 9 months in a halfway house. I met a sponsor, you know, clearly what seemed to be the wrong guy. I wanted kind of a downtown guy, and he was not that, you know. He was, he had every color of pastel sweater that you've ever seen, and you're like a wonderful happy man, you know, who saved my life and who gave me a lot of firm direction, and one of the things that really became important to me was willingness. You know, I couldn't figure out while I'm in the halfway house, you know, for 9 months, and then I moved down the street, so I was like pretty much around the halfway house for a year and a half. This was important to me because I had to stop doing everything else. I had to have, like, an awful job with French fries. I had to have, you know, I had to have nothing else going on in my life. You know, I had to, like, give up everything else because I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't multitask anything and get sober. You know, and a lot of what was early on important to me were people asking me, "What are you willing to do to stay sober?" That was like the most important question I heard. You know, definitely. I didn't think it was. I felt it was pretty confrontational. honestly, I did. But it scared me. You know, and I did feel like although I had the years of suicidal fantasies, I did feel like before I eventually stopped drinking, man, I'm gonna die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die next month. I'm going to be wrapped around a tree. I'm going to, out of a sense of, like, you know, just exasperation, I'm going to drive into a turnpike abutment. You know, like, that's going to happen. That's coming at me. Or someone's going to kill me, you know, because I'm, like, having bad experiences. Or I'm just going to die. Thank you. And that was motivating. You know, although I had all the suicidal fantasies, when it came down to it, I didn't want to die. You know, and it felt like, if I don't do this, you know, if I don't, like, give in here and find out what they're doing and, like, try to do it, I'm dead, you know. I really felt that. And I had earlier got on my knees, you know, like they said, but I didn't believe in God. I had huge resentment against God. But I got on my knees, you know, but that wasn't enough. I needed to be totally willing to do whatever they said. And what I found out is even being totally willing, given a couple of days, I wasn't totally willing. You know, it's hard to stay willing for more than a few minutes at a time, or for me, you know, for more than a few days at a time, you know. And one of the best things I could say about my first sponsor is that he gave me, like, little willingness hurdles, you know, things that I didn't want to do and that I felt like I was superior to and that I was obviously too smart for and that I understood anyway. So why should I have to do them, you know? And I had to do them, you know. So that was a big part of my early sobriety, the halfway house, the, you know, living in, you know, in that, and, you know, having no money. And if you drink, you're out of the halfway house. You have no money. You're in a foreign place. Like, what's going to happen? You know, it was very, like, you know, cliffside. So what happened for me? You know, I've been sober 17 years. That was the first year and a half. What happened to me? I'll tell you this, and more getting back to what I feel like me being, you know, a newcomer and also someone with some time. I'm not a joiner, you know. I'm not a joiner. I never was a joiner. I never wanted to be a member of a group. I always felt suspicious of every group I was a member of, and I always held myself back a little, you know. I did. I always was in school. I was always trying to work my way to the back of the class so I could have a running critique of how they were, you know, wrong. And, you know, I moved back to New York after this, and, you know, sponsorship didn't work out, and I was on the sixth step, you know, which stopped me cold, and I moved back to New York, and I got a sponsor, and it didn't really work out. You know, I had meetings, and I did meetings for a few years, and I did service. I did meetings and service. I went out to coffee. I had hoped, you know, and this was a big learning experience in my sobriety. You know, at 7 years sober, 6 years sober, I just wanted to die. You know, it didn't work for me big time. I had hoped that meetings would carry the weight of my sobriety, and they wouldn't, you know, not at that level. It just wouldn't happen, you know. I was hoping that meetings would do it. They wouldn't do it, you know. I needed a program. And, you know, if I went to any meetings in my neighborhood, they knew who I was. I shared. I bought cookies. I did, you know, I did all that stuff. You know, I mean, like, I was a regular, you know, a regular dying member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. A regular unhappy, resentful, you know, dying member who was keeping score with everybody, you know. You know, I, honest to God, when I was 6 years sober, I could sit in my apartment at 2 p.m. and wait for the sun to go down, you know. And just, like, you know, this isn't working, you know. And I knew it wasn't working, you know. And I thought, you know, I thought maybe it would get better. But I knew I wasn't following, you know, what was outlined. I mean, that was obvious enough. But I don't know if it was that serious, right? So that I should actually, you know. You know, I really felt like I really stuck to my guns. You know, that's it. You know, the not joiner thing, the hold back thing, that, you know. That I really did. I really wanted to manage my way out of this because, you know, I've been through the program. I've done a fourth step. I've done a fifth step. You know, what more is there? You know, I did come across a guy who, you know, by accident, when I was near the end of my rope, I came across a guy who had the light in his eyes and who I totally believed, had less time than me. And I believed that he believed, you know. And it turned my program around completely, you know, completely. And I worked the steps again rigorously. And for the first time, because I had stopped at the sixth step, you know, which had stopped me. And I had also, and I hope I have a couple of minutes to talk about this. I had also always held myself back somewhat from the spiritual aspects of the program, you know. And I will finish with that. I'll talk about that. Because when I came in here, you know, I come from a religious background. I did active work in my late teens, early 20s to disassemble and, you know, destroy any, you know, spiritual insight I ever had, you know. I didn't want any part of it. I resented the whole thing. And when I came in here, I was horrified to see God and to hear people who didn't lower their voices when they said God. I didn't, out of embarrassment, not out of reverence. I didn't want it, you know, and I tried, you know, I tried because they told me I had to try, and I tried, you know, and I tried to intellectualize it, you know, I tried to come up with, I thought, okay, I have to do the theology, you know, which is what I would never wanted to do, but I tried to come up with, like, a total understanding of God that I could, like, totally keep under my thumb, you know, a total intellectual understanding that was bounded and that I was in control of, you know, and it didn't work, you know, it really didn't work, and I had to redo it, you know. I had to redo it, and I didn't want to, and I was afraid of it, you know. I was afraid of what I would lose, you know. And that was the process for me, you know. That was the most meaningful process for me, you know. That I had held off on that for so long, you know. And I imagine, although I could be wrong, that there are people who are new who are horrified to the spiritual aspects of the program, you know, and I take great comfort, and I took great comfort in Bill's story, you know. That became like the most important thing for me, you know, because Bill's story, you know, the guy has lost several fortunes on Wall Street, and he's dying, you know. He's stealing money out of his wife's purse, and he's offered a spiritual solution, and he says no. And then he gives the reasons, and he says, you know, he doesn't like the idea of a czar of the heavens, and he believes in rationality. He goes out through the details, you know, in Bill's story. And then, your own conception of God, you know, which was most important for me. Most important for me to hear that, you know, him looking back on his experiences in sobriety, that he found that he took the, first of all, that God doesn't make too hard terms on those that seek him, meaning I don't have to get it right. I don't have to nail it, you know. And also that looking back, he took it piecemeal. You know, he talked to scores of men who he had said felt the same way. And that was the opening for me. And his Abby Thatcher, I guess, suggestion that he should choose his own conception of God. You know, I feel like that was a big thing for me, and I feel like that. You know, I was one of those guys who was horrified, and now I am not. To hear the book say that the purpose of the book is to help bring me in touch with a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. You know, and that's, you know, that's the reality for me. You know, because I won't solve my problem; I'll make it worse. You know, I made it worse over and over again. And I still have an urge to make it worse. You know, I still have an urge to do it myself. I still do, you know. Getting back to, you know, I want to thank all the people, who do service at these meetings, you know. And I do service at this meeting, you know. But not being a joiner, I really feel like it's hard to be a member of a group, you know. It is hard to be a member of a group, you know. I feel like some days, sometimes like a total fraud, you know, that I haven't got it. You know, and what I have convinced myself to do is when that happens, show up and try to be helpful. And I've also convinced myself that, like, you know, these guys just aren't doing it right, you know. And that's that has come up, you know, again and again, because, you know, I'll figure my way right out of here. You know, that's still a possibility for me. I still believe. I in fact know that, you know, that that is still available for me, that I'm an alcoholic and that is available for me, that I could walk everything in my apartment right out the door. That's real. You know, I could really do that. That's possible. And that I don't have to if I'm willing, you know. And the other thing that became really, really important for me in my sobriety, the most important thing became willingness, because you don't have to be smart, you know. You just have to be willing. You don't have to have insight. You just have to do it. You just have to show up. It's a muscular activity. It's an activity. It's not an insight. It's not thought. You don't have to think it. You don't have to figure it out. Because I would blow it. I'm sure of it. I am. Thank you. So the willingness became the most important thing for me. And interestingly, the thing that I have some control over, you know, that I can you know, choose to be willing, regardless of my thoughts or feelings. For the longest time, you know, for the longest time, I insisted that my feelings gave me true information about the world. You know, that's how I ran my life. It seemed obvious, you know, that they gave me clear-cut true information about the world, and usually with like an asterisk of how to behave, you know. And that's not true. You know, that's hugely not true. You know, I mean, I'm a danger to myself and others. If, you know, left to my own devices, it's true. But I'm not, in fact, you know, I'm not. What else can I say? I would urge those of you who are new, although you may be afraid of it and may not like it, to consider the spiritual aspects of the program, because it has saved my life. And the other, everything else, but without that, I tried. And I tried it for years, and it didn't work. And it would have taken me right out. Like, I would have drank. Or actually, really, you know, what people who are sober do when it's not working is they, like, kill themselves or misbehave terribly, you know. You know, something, you know. But I tried it. I tried it backwards and forwards without God. And it didn't work. And one of the encouraging, you know, the other thing is, I would say that is that, you know, what has been really important to me, as I said, was God doesn't make too hard terms on those that seek him. You know, we're all very circumspect on how we speak about our relative higher powers. I've gone to meetings with some of you for years, and I don't know what your notion of a higher power is, you know. And I don't need to. I need to have my own notion of a higher power and be in service of him or her. And that's it. So thank you very much for letting me share, and thank you for my sobriety.